This is Hidden Killers Half Year in Review. A look back at some of the most compelling cases of 2026 so far. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
We had a lot to break down today as we do a little review of the case of Corey Richens. We're going to talk all about the psychological end of the whole case, from Corey to Eric, how it all played out, why it all worked the way it did. But we're going to begin today with a video, because I found it's rather interesting to look back on this case at certain aspects now that the prism has aligned itself to show that she is, in fact, guilty, that a jury of her peers found that she was lying her ass off the entire time, including to Good Day Utah, or whatever the hell the program was, where Corey goes on, and we've all heard about it, we've all seen clips of this, where Corey is promoting her children's book, Are You With Me? Seeing it from this perspective, knowing that all of it was a lie, is really interesting. So I want to bring in Robin Drake, our co-host, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author of this book right here. It's Nightbird, available wherever books are sold. And break down, and we're going to play the video, and we're going to kind of work our way through it, stop, because there's just a lot of interesting observations that I know I was making, and I'd love to get your guys' opinions on what we are seeing as we go through this video. And as we watch this, you guys in the comments section, please do weigh in with your thoughts on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the descriptions, and we'll try and get through your comments and your questions as we work through this. So let's begin with this, Todd, and let's just go right into the video, and then we'll stop here at a certain point, and I'm going to throw it over to you guys to get your thoughts. So Corey Richens, this is her, I believe. Do we have it, the video, ready?
Yep, here we go.
Okay, this is her on that Good Day Utah program promoting the book. What do we got? Do we
have audio? To helping kids cope with grief. And Corey, I want to start with your story. What happened in your personal life?
So my husband passed away unexpectedly last year. So it's March 4th was a 1 year anniversary for us, and he was 39. It completely took us all by shock. And we have three little boys, 10, 9, and 6. And, you know, my kids and I kind of wrote this book on the different emotions and grieving processes that we've experienced last year. And
let's pause for a second. My kids and I wrote this book on the various grieving processes we've been experiencing this past year. All lie. She didn't write the book. It was a ghostwriter. But she's the first thing out of her mouth to the folks at the TV station is, we wrote the book and it helped with the grieving process. Siobhan, I want to start with you. What are we watching here?
Lying, impression management. You know, she wants to look like someone we should all have empathy and compassion for. And I really don't understand. You see people do this a lot of celebrities, the whole ghostwriter thing. Mm-hmm. And then they win book awards and go on shows and talk about, oh, the process of writing. And then when you get under the surface, they didn't write the damn book. I wrote my own book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so it's children's weird. Book, too. It's not like you'd be really, I mean, illustration, if that's not your thing. You know, at the time, AI really wasn't out yet. So, like, you couldn't really. But, I mean, you could have written the damn book. It's a children's book. There's like a sentence on a page. It's like it's less than two paragraphs at the end of the day. So then to say that, you know, this is an exercise in healing and grief. And I, if you did it, cool. That's nice. It's unique. You know, but obviously you didn't do it. Robin, obviously we're only 10 seconds in, but what's your initial feelings here?
Yeah. So what we do when we first observe situations like this is we take in what we're seeing and we automatically start baselining, and we baseline what their normal is in the situation. And what you normally do when you're watching an interview or doing an interview or watching someone engage, typically they start with a baseline so you can get what comfort looks like in someone. And then you can see what we're seeing from an escalation for discomfort or grief or emotions. But they kind of hit it right off the bat of kind of hit it right on the grief process and what the book was written about, right? So you expect to see something other than a casual kind of baseline, because a lot of times it's not just what we see, it's what we don't see. And so for everyone watching this and listening and tuning in, this is what I was doing when I first looked at this video. Not just do your own thought experiment on what you would feel like or expect to see or what you would feel like in those moments, because that's what deep empathy is, which she is lacking, which our viewers are definitely commenting on. But do this. Compare and contrast what you see from her now, talking about the death of her husband and most importantly, as a mother talking about her kids grieving. Does it look any different than any other emotion she gave in court? Does it look any different from anything you're seeing else? In other words, what I'm seeing is a bandwidth of empathy, nonverbal empathy, of about zero.
Yeah.
So it's what we're not seeing. We're not seeing any sort of affect of any impact emotionally on her at all. And she has them. But her emotional impact, the only time you see anything anywhere here or in court or anywhere else is when it impacts her.
Yeah.
So that's the baseline I saw at the beginning.
The flat affect on this interview is really what got me and through the whole thing. It's like you're really talking about something very emotional. It's not like this is a book on your favorite, sushi rolls or something. Like this is about death. This is about helping and just talking about it like, nothing. Okay, let's go back to the video. Let's watch a chunk of it here and let's all absorb what we're about to see. Continue on.
That it can kind of help other kids, deal with this and kind of, find happiness some way or another.
And to make sense and process, I'm sure. And I'm sure you felt that going through and trying to explain it and articulate it for you and your boys.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And so I've done, I'm new to all of this. So kind of doing, research and reading books and things to try and understand, not only how to grieve as a widow, as a wife, but also, with my kids, how to help them understand what just happened. And what I have kind of found is, as I mentioned, it's kind of the three C's is how I has visualize it. And it's, connection, continuity, and care. And it's, making sure connection is the one major one and making sure that their spirit is always alive in your home, and memories are always brought up and doing things that your loved ones love to do, whether it's riding bikes or their favorite dinner and just constantly, talking about them. And
Corey, do you mention at dinner, here's dad or dad would like this meal or dad
yes.
would,
yeah.
let's bring dad on a bike ride.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, explaining to my kid just because he's not present here with us physically, that doesn't mean his presence isn't here with us and he's doing these things with us. And he's, here for birthdays and he's here for Christmas and it's just comforting to them to know that, they're not living this life alone. Like dad is still here. It's just in a different way, a different version.
Well, I Let's opened pause. Up your book Let's and one of the here. First pages I saw.
Got the three C's going on here, the connection, continuity, and care. I want to ask you, Siobhan, what you're taking here, because I want to see if my take on this is right. It's interesting. The hosts are almost kind of telling her how to feel at the beginning.
Yeah, no kidding. They're funny.
They're like filling in the blanks. Yes, this is how I should be feeling. But it's interesting to me because what I see here, I mean, as monstrous as it seems to be what Corey did is monstrous, but the fact that I think we're seeing a very raw moment of her where she doesn't know what to feel or how to feel because she's incapable of feeling it. She's having to read books to learn how to feel. She's flat out saying it like, I was reading books, how to grieve as a wife. Now, I mean, I think a lot of us who go through traumas, we turn to books, we turn to things to help us process it and work through it. But it's almost like she's looking for the guidebook. How do the rest of the humans handle something like this? How should I be acting like this? Because I don't naturally do it. What was your take there?
Yeah, it's like she's role playing. She's trying to pretend to be someone with empathy and compassion, which, as everybody says, she does not have that.
Yeah.
But it's this impression management, which goes into the narcissism, you know, and also the Machiavellianism, this strategic way of thinking. And people like that study other people to try to figure out, how do I put on the mask of normalcy here?
Mm-hmm.
And how do I do it? And it sounds like almost a very conscious attempt on her part. Sometimes they're not conscious that they're doing it, but it sounds conscious for her. It's like, I need to play a role here. How do I do it? And I'll bet those three C's came from the ghostwriter, because come from her.
And I'm going to bet, like, there's an obliviousness to her speaking these words that other people don't feel this need, don't feel this, let me go get a book to tell me how I should be we just have it, but she's needing. And the thing is, and this is interesting, because there's a ton of people who do lack empathy, who that is low on their feeling scale or non-existent. You have it with a lot of folks with Asperger's and on the autism scale, where it's an emotion that is sometimes hard to feel and hard to empathize and understand how other people are feeling. It doesn't turn them into Corey Richens and murderers. But they do have to take some cues from learned behavior and go, oh, if you want to integrate with the rest of society and not always kind of be off here on the side looking odd, this is how people act. And many people are able to do that and function and interact with society in some way, shape, or form. And sometimes they're faking it till they make it to a certain extent, but they're able to fit in and go, okay, even though I am lacking over here, this is, I've learned over time, this is how people act. And they get along just fine. And then you got the Corys, which is very different. Robin, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, and I'm curious what Siobhan thinks about this too, because it's a thought, and I'm curious about your thoughts on this. She was also using the word, and I couldn't tell whether it was a filler word, because she says you know a lot, which is a filler word for people. But she's also using kind of. And when I heard her first use kind of, it's in reference to her feelings, her emotions, and what the purpose of the book is. It's kind of this, it's kind of this. I wasn't quite sure whether she's using it as a filler word, or she really wasn't quite sure the purpose of what she was doing or the book, which goes to the whole point of she's not really emotionally connected to that book. She didn't even have empathy for what she wrote. So Siobhan, did you see it as a filler or as a word modifier for her emotion?
I think you nailed it with the second, although she did use, you know, constantly, which was driving
me
crazy.
Right, that is right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that means the person is trying to grasp at what they want to say because they're not really sure what they want to say. So they're doing that with this little delay here for what am I going to say here? But yeah, the lack of connection, the lack of affect, as Tony said, with it is really striking. And yes, it just speaks to me that she's trying to, what is the right thing to say here? What am I supposed to say? What's the response I'm supposed to give?
And again, so she had two of them. She had, you know, and kind of. She used kind of a lot.
Yeah.
And there's only one other visual thing I saw, and I didn't have time to really research this. Again, it's just an impression I got. And I'm curious your thoughts on this. When she held up her hands, she's not wearing a wedding ring. So there would have been, it's not that she had to, but I notice things that stand out. And I've known people that have lost spouses and yet they'll wear that wedding ring for quite a while until they have found someone else. And now we know in hindsight she was cheating and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But you would think if she was that good at strategic thinking, it would have made a big empathetic play on the audience had she actually kept her wedding ring on.
Yeah, that was a really good catch. I missed that one. But that's true. People wear those wedding rings for years often, and that just shows the bond that they had. And I would guess she took it off the morning after and was ready to move on.
It's already sold. It's already sold.
Yeah. It's like already on eBay right after she's putting the bottle down that she's pouring. Okay, mule's done, ring off. Here you go, Eric.
Yes, even my mother-in-law, I mean, when my father-in-law passed, I mean, she wore the rings for a very long time, until she found someone else finally.
Yeah. Hard to take it off.
It is, especially if there's a connection.
Exactly. It's the loss of the connection. But it also makes me think she's trying to think strategically, as she did with all her business wheeling and dealing, but she's not very good at it.
Yes. And I wanted to hit on that too, Siobhan, because I'm really curious about your impression of her skill set at this, because if she is, I mean, she had a lifetime of learning how and practicing manipulation. And part of that is that perception management and knowing, like you said earlier, that she has to present what people are expecting her to present emotionally, yet she seems to be completely sucking at it. Do you think this was like a new revelation that she has to present something, or do you think this is just she's got zero skill set to even learn that capacity?
This may sound blunt, but I'll go ahead and say it because it's just what keeps coming back into my mind as I watch her and hear more about her story and all the missteps. She's not the brightest person. Mm-mm. And clearly lacks insight and wants to be this, you know, Machiavellian master and control everything and make money and get rich and eliminate anybody who's in her way. She just blunders constantly. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you just wonder about if she were smarter, would she have gotten away with more? Probably.
Well, if she's smarter, she wouldn't have to do what she did. You know, we hit this all the time on the show. Smart people don't do these stupid things, because if these people were actually smart, they wouldn't have to resort to doing stupid things.
Exactly.
What I would love to see, and I'm so curious about, is who's in her ear? Like, who's telling her, hey, maybe you should do this, maybe you should do that? Because I don't know that Corey's coming up with all these ideas on her own. I have suspicions there. It will be interesting to see if any of that pans out. Let's watch the rest of this video and the rest of her fine appearance on Good Things Utah.
As a little boy, it looks like he's standing in a hallway at school and he's saying, are you still here?
Yes. Yeah. And it's, you know, and that was like the first day of school and, you know, all the nerves that kids face on the first day of school with new, you know, and just hoping, you know, dad, like, walk with me, like, help me get through today. Like, give me the strength to do that. And it has found, you know, it's been a lot of peace for my kids to, you know, to really remember that in the back of their head, that they're never alone, you know. So
you actually wrote this book with your children.
I did.
Mm-hmm. And it's only been a year. How did you process and say go from processing death to I need to write a book and help others?
You know, I just watched the struggle that my kids were going through. And I actually, you know, I went on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and trying to find something that we could use to cope at nights. Nights are the hardest, it seems like, for everybody when, you know, dealing with anything. But I just wanted some story to read to my kids at night. And I just could not find anything. I couldn't find anything that really, you know, suited them or helped them find comfort and peace. And so, you know, I was like, let's just write one. And so, you know, I took things that my kids have said to me this last year and we kind of articulated it and put it into a story and, you know, just have hopes that it will help other kids.
Grief is not linear, and this sounds like it's a touchstone when you need it to come back to for you and your boys. So the first one you had mentioned was connection of the three C's, keeping the person's spirit alive. The second, continuity.
Yes, and that's, you know, just making sure you're trying to stay, you know, as much as you can on routine. And, you know, whether that's, you know, sports or pick up and drop off from school or community activities, just, you know, trying to stay in a routine as much as possible.
And then the last C is care.
Yes.
What does that mean?
So, you know, on top of just loving your kids and hugging them and kissing them and, you know, extra cuddles and everything, I think it's important that I've learned to really affirm, you know, their feelings. When they're mad or they're sad, you know, it's just that affirmation of, I understand, like, that you are upset, you know, because of this. Like, let's talk about it, you know. And so I think, really, it's not, you know, it's the emotional and physical touch of it But really letting your kids understand that you know why they're feeling the way that they are feeling, and it's okay, and let's deal with it and talk about it.
There's a promotion right now. Get a free copy of the book April 30th and May 1st through Amazon Kindle. You are an amazing woman and mom, and thank you for being vulnerable and sharing this and touching the lives of others.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here. So,
thank you.
Wonder how many criminals show up on daytime television to further their stories. I mean, it's basically, she's like explaining how to manipulate my children. Here's what I did, and I have it with the effect of like, hey, there's Cheetos on sale at the Piggly Wiggly.
Before we get going, she said something that's very interesting in there that's relevant to this. I thought, you know me doing my research as we're talking. There are currently over 10,000 results of books out on Amazon for kids dealing with grief and the death of a parent.
Not according to Corey.
I mean, there's actually a lot. You know, there's pretty compelling ones. You know, when dinosaurs die, healing your grieving heart for kids. Fall of Freddy the Leaf, something very sad happened. I mean, there's a lot on there. So, again, she thought she's some savior for kids coming out writing this book about how to murder your husband and make your kids think you didn't do it.
Let's just write one. It's like, I want to be Joanna Gaines. There's so let's just take $250K from my husband and blow it on homes that we're going to lose money
on. She did a lot of research, yeah.
Yeah, let's just do it. You know? Siobhan, what's your thoughts?
It's just one of the strangest things. And yes, when you mentioned daytime TV with, you know, murderers coming on, made me think of the guy that went on the dating game.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And got the date. He won. And it turns out to be a serial killer, right?
Bundy, right? California. Wasn't it Bundy that did
it? No, it wasn't Bundy. I think it was Alcala. Rodney Alcala.
Okay. Yep.
But, you know, on the dating game, they made a movie on Netflix about it. I mean, talk about creepy.
It's like where you, it's where you least expect them or you would think that they, but that's, they're hiding in plain sight. And through this book, it was really Corey Richens attempting to hide in plain sight. It was a diversion technique or that she was attempting to employ on her children and on society and on everyone. Look at me. I'm a lovely grieving widow. I just have no emotions. And Jesus, yeah. Your thoughts in the comment section on that video. It's more creepy to look at it now than ever before. Love to get your thoughts there.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now. And don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Nobody marries somebody they believe will destroy them. They marry someone who feels like a missing piece, someone who shows up with everything they didn't know they needed. That's not stupidity. That's how this works. Before we talk about what Corey Richens allegedly did, we need to understand what the beginning of a relationship like this actually looks like, because the people most at risk are often the strongest, most capable ones in the room. And they're also unsuspecting of this type of behavior if they've never experienced before, which makes them an easy mark for folks like Corey Richens. But why? Why is it that empathetic, loving, caring, genuine human beings are a mark for certain types of personality? With us to help break all of this down, my co-host, Robin Drake, former FBI, head of the FBI's Behavioral Intelligence, Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Unit, and Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author. Siobhan, let's start with you. Why is it? Why was Eric Richens such a mark from what we know about his personality, his loving affect, his nature, his goodness with the children, providing for his family, taking care of his family, letting them, you know, doing everything he did? Why is that a mark for someone to just latch onto and basically suck dry like a black widow?
Yeah. Predators have an uncanny intuition for people who have a lot of empathy, people who have a work ethic, people who make commitments and follow through. They have integrity. They try hard. And predators are always looking for, what am I going to get out of this deal? Mm-hmm. So they go into these relationships with this, you know, the popular term is love bombing, with this incredible energy for this intense, passionate connection trying to read what will feed this other person. And it's very powerful. And it's something that it doesn't have anything to do with intelligence. I know lots of absolutely brilliant, high-functioning people who have been manipulated into relationships with people who were ultimately predators. Mm-hmm. And once, you know, there are all these processes that get going, but it starts with that intense sense of connection and bonding and making the victim feel, I really see you and I value you. They give them lots of praise, and it's a powerful drug.
Yeah, we were getting ready for an interview once of a really high-level, clinically diagnosed psychopath, and our operational psychologist was with us on our team. And I remember every time we were coming up with a strategy for the dialogue and interaction, we were kept reverting to who we were as human beings to build that connection and empathetic connection, which we will typically do when trying to inspire someone to share information with us. Mm-hmm. And our psychologist kept reminding us, if you display empathy, they're going to use that as a lever of manipulation against you, because that is actually what these high-level narcissists, psychopaths, and things do. Is they, like Siobhan was saying, they identify your weakness to them, and your weakness to them, that is that lever of manipulation, or as Robert Cialdini says, a lever of influence, is mm-hmm. that empathy, because they don't have it. And so they see it as a tool that can be a big lever and can crank yeah. down on as much as they need to. So the more empathy you have, the more vulnerable you are.
Yeah. And they'll also do things like tell things about their past, the hardships that they've gone through, and they weaponize this sense of I'm a victim.
Yeah.
And the empathic person gets really sucked into that. They're compassionate. They want to help them. They want to support them.
Feign vulnerability.
Yeah, exactly. That's another super common theme.
And it's interesting because empathic people, and when they're love bombed, I think to a lot of folks it who are empathic and not psychopathic or narcissistic or borderline or whatever, if you're just a very empathic person, that reads to you, if you haven't experienced it before, as wow, this is how I'd love to be loved, because I think there's a lot of empathic people who probably love bomb too, not necessarily, you know, in a way that's for control or some sort of other divisive reason, but because they're authentic, because when they feel that they're being loved and they're being cared about and they're in that sort of situation, they want the other person to know that, and they want the other person mm-hmm. to see that. So they don't necessarily recognize the love bombing from a character like that as anything other than love. Why is it so hard for empathic people to distinguish between what love bombing is when it is insincere, when it is being used as some other measure that is not love, but is more for coercive control, and authentic, genuine affection and love and care that's coming from another human being? What makes it so difficult to differentiate the two?
It's really hard to tell. And I think people who are honest, who have integrity, they're not out there trying to manipulate. Mm-hmm. And so we all project ourselves onto other people. It's just normal. And so when we're honest, when we're sincere, when we feel real compassion and affection for other people, we assume that when they express those things back, that it's genuine. You know, most of us, I mean, you guys and I, we've probably gotten to the point where we're pretty suspicious in life right now. And we look at everything very closely and analyze, but I don't think most people do. And I can completely understand that. I was that younger, naive person that believed what I was told and what appeared to be genuine behavior. But the other piece, which I find really interesting, is the neuroscience of bonding. Mm-hmm. And early in these intense relationships, in truth, I think most of the time people say they fall in love. Mm-hmm. It's this neurobiological process where we get flooded with dopamine, oxytocin, and endogenous opioids. And that is the recipe for a drug addiction, mm-hmm. which is why people can be a bit non-rational when they're in the early phases of a relationship. And that may last 3 or 4 months. It may last up to 2 years. We actually title it now with the term limerence, you know, whereas looking at a long-term relationship, those neurochemicals tend to diminish over time and people form those deeper bonds that are long lasting. But everybody's, you know, subject to our neurobiology. And that's one of my big lines now is kids don't trust the hormones, right? Because they can lead you astray. And it's very possible to bond very deeply with someone who truly has a predatory agenda and isn't going to be good for you.
You know, Siobhan, you really hit that key word right there. Is agenda. And someone who is really empathetic, cares very deeply, and they have life reps of love bombing free of an agenda, so they are actually doing it out of the caring and compassion of others. They don't realize that there are some people like Corey that are actually doing exactly the same thing, doing that love bombing with an agenda. So they're not wholly present. They're doing it for their gain, not your welfare. So this is the toughest question in the world, or one of them. How do you recognize the red flag between the difference between love bombing with an agenda and love bombing because it's actually caring and nurturing?
Yeah, that's the book we need to write, huh? Yeah. It's tough. I think one of the things that I have found increasingly important over the years is look at their history. What is their history? Yeah. And I mean, their legal history, their financial history, is there a record of duplicitous behavior? Is there, you know, a really rocky history of relationships? Do they play the victim a lot? I mean, I question those narratives now when somebody comes right out up front and talks about how every awful thing has happened to them, because that can be manipulative. But sometimes it's hard to tell. And I'm thinking of a lot of people I know who are incredibly bright physicians, psychiatrists, you know, people we look at and go, oh, they've got to really be smart. And you know, they are very intelligent, but they can get fooled by this kind of stuff too, because some of these people are just really good.
I was thinking of an analogy, and this is the first time I'm going to try and say it out loud. It kind of came to me as we're going through this, so I hope it makes somewhat sense. Folks that are empathetic are not always the most selective when it comes to discerning what appears in front of them as something good, or someone that needs something. If there's a need, if someone is suffering from something, and you can fill that need, you can help them. You can help them with their traumas, which they oftentimes project early on. If you are really deeply empathetic, you want to be there. Oftentimes through trial and error and life and getting burned, I think a lot of us learn boundaries at some point, hopefully, and we become a little bit more discerning. But early on, you're kind of like a kid. At the Sunday bar, it's like you got the ice cream. All of this looks good. You're like, I'm going to put M&Ms, some Reese's, some of these bobas, and you end up with just this pile of shit on your, and it's at the end, you're like, you know, just that those pieces of toffee over there and a little caramel syrup might have been far more satisfying than gummy worms and everything else on here. Or like a buffet at a restaurant. You're like, gosh, this all looks really good. And it's all very average food. And at the end, you go, you know, if I really would just pick like my favorite thing and just focused on getting that and having that, I would have walked away from this meal much more satisfied and much more fulfilled. But there's just so much, and you're wanting to take it all. And with people, you're wanting to help. You're wanting to be and give yourself in every which way you can to someone that is in need. I akin it to that. And it's an interesting behavior exercise. I'd be really curious as to people with deep empathy, how they handle buffets and how they handle Sunday bars. What that would tell if someone who really loads it up, if that's a really empathetic person, that, you know, just doesn't can't really solely focus or take some time or just hasn't been burned enough to get there. I don't know. It's an interesting thought process. Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts, Siobhan?
Yeah, I like that analogy. And it's the other thing about it is it's kind of empowering to be that empathic person who's being manipulated. But it's kind of empowering to feel like, you know, I can help here. I can give. And that, for having been in that kind of relationship myself, which I talk about in the book, you get kind of sucked in to, it feels good to be in the position of thinking that you're doing something helpful to someone. Mm-hmm. And in truth, from what we know about studying predatory people in relationships, there's no helping. There's no helping, because the person that you think you are in love with is not who the person really is. And that's another piece of this that's very hard to reconcile.
And I think it's so important, because I think one of the most damaging things that can happen is when you have someone, one of the, I call them life's, the world's beautiful people, the world's beautiful people that are these beautiful, empathetic, give you the shirt off their back, just pour it all out to you. When they get really burned and they get afraid of the world, they get afraid of relationships, they get afraid of engaging, they get afraid to trust people, the pendulum will swing back the other way, and it's so painful, and they get too pessimistic and skeptical of others. I don't like that, because it's mentally for ourselves, for the person that is that empath, it hurts even more when you're doing it to yourself. What I have found, one of the greatest mitigators of most things in life, one, when you're assessing others, you're looking for transparency and that vulnerability, because that's the red flags that I'm doing for, is this someone who's willing to engage healthy? And are they problem solvers or wound collectors, as we love to say? Mm-hmm. And Siobhan, you made a great point on that. Are they seeing themselves as victims and wound collecting? Is that is that their habit, default mechanism? Or, like I like to roll and be positive. And so even when you deal with people that are going to burn you, and you've been burned, I challenge you to don't let go of thinking the best in people. Don't let go of trusting first. I will always lead with trust until I don't. And one way I have personally countered, and I say, I am so sorry, I throw two I statements in here. Give yourself the power of curiosity. When you see, and this, so you add to your life more curiosity and loving critics. Mm-hmm. And so when the loving critic in your life, and this is the person you're going to share things with, share this beautiful new relationship, and that loving critic, they can be extremely empathetic as well. Perfect. Great. Or a little more pragmatic. It doesn't matter. But they're not vested in that relationship like you are. So you can share it with them. And when they're telling you this might be a red flag, here's what you don't do. Don't dismiss their red flag. Mm-hmm. And the way you do it then is just get curious. Ask the person that you're engaging, that you're pouring out this empathy through, just ask for some transparency. Ask questions. Be curious. And if you're starting getting blocking, blading, avoidance of those questions, now it's time to back off. So, but be positive, man. Human beings, one of the greatest things about even doing our show is engaging in great conversation with other people, so we can recognize, hey, this is healthy, this is unhealthy. I won't judge it. I'm just going to put the nutter. There's my nutter. I had to throw it out once today. Over here.
Yeah. No, that's excellent advice. And I noticed, you know, with the kind of work and the folks I've worked with, and I work with lots of absolutely lovely, wonderful, non-personality disordered people too. But when you work a lot with severely mentally ill and violent people, you develop a level of paranoia. Yeah. And I find that with my neighbors, and it's really funny because my husband is a really friendly guy and he'll be out talking to all the neighbors. And I am very reticent. It's like, you know, boundaries, 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 boundaries. And I have to talk to myself about that. You know, smile and wave. Not everybody is a serial killer in the neighborhood. It's okay. But yeah, it's a challenge to monitor our own thinking and emotional responses to the world.
Your thoughts in the comment section thus far on YouTube and Substack. We'd love to get your feedback on this case, and be sure to press subscribe wherever you are listening.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.